is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Could you tell an archaeologist from their bones?
And what's Helen most proud of?
Answers to those questions and more on this episode of the Time Team Podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team Podcast. I'm Martin Williams, that is Dr. Helen Geek, and this is the podcast that helps you to understand history and archaeology and the world beneath our feet. And we like to do that sometimes through answering your questions. And by yours, I mean Time Team members. If you do support us on Patreon, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, you get the opportunity to join our little community chat section. You can go and find it there where you can ask Helen a question. Lots of people have done that. I've been wading through them and I picked out a few, Helen, that I think will sort of tantalise you, and maybe we can learn a little bit more about you, archaeology, history, the archaeology process and Time Team itself. You quite enjoy answering these, don't you?
I do, because they always give me a different perspective on the world of archaeology and of the past in general. It's all very well just talking to yourself, but it's so much better to hear what other people want to know.
I'm going to be acting as your representative here, the question asker throughout this. So I'm going to sort of put my thinking cap on and try and get the best out of the question and things like that. I also thought I might share with you a little bit of Time Team, you know, behind the scenes stuff, because we like to do that on the podcast as well. And recently I was having a very interesting, Helen, this might be news to you, I was having a very interesting conversation with our director, Emily, and we were talking about ideas. Both of us had gone to our best space for getting ideas. For me, it's the shower. I think Emily was sort of just in between sleep and awake at one point. We were having these like dreams, daydreams about what we could do at the moment when the Sutton Hoo ship reconstruction that they're working on in Woodbridge right now to reconstruct the Anglo-Saxon ship that is buried under some of the mounds at Sutton Hoo, when that finally, whenever it is, takes to the water, what can we do as Time Team? And we had lots and lots and lots of ideas. I was very inspired by, you know, when NASA sent that moon rocket up and they've got all the different angles of the cameras covering it and they've got like experts talking in a little screen on the side telling you what's going on. That's my dream. I'd love that.
That would be great. That would be really exciting. Having all sorts of different experts, like we could have somebody who's an expert on rivers saying, and now a big wave is going to come up and splash them all. And we could have somebody else who's an expert in people rowing, you know, and someone's going to crick their arm, you know, and absolutely.
I want somebody to say, and this is the point of maximum Q, this is maximum Q. I don't know what maximum Q is, but it sounds great when they say it in NASA. So this is what I want to happen. But anyway, look, watch this. There was also some talk from Emily about divers in water. I think we got carried away at that point, but watch this space.
Have you ever been in the deep end?
No. I've been near the deep end, close enough to know that maybe putting a camera underwater is not going to get the best results, I would say.
I don't think so.
We got very excited, which is probably good news, but that is not going to happen for a little while, but cogs are a-whirring. Just thought I'd let you in on that. Shall we get to the questions? And this one comes from Laura. This is Laura Panoff, who says, "Hi Helen, I'm going to the dentist for a cleaning next week." This is such a good question. I love this. "How will the lack of the buildup of plaque on our teeth affect archaeology in the future?" What a great question and something I'd never thought of before.
No, I think Laura must have been in one of those places that helps you think, you know, like in the shower, or, or maybe just lying back in the dentist's chair and trying to think of something else. Well, that is a great question. It's about one of the newest techniques in osteoarchaeology, looking at remains that are they're almost literally fossilized in your dental plaque, because as time goes on, plaque becomes kind of concreted onto your teeth, kind of mineralized into what they call tartar or calculus. And it preserves, as it goes, it preserves bits of food and mouth bacteria. So you can tell what people were eating and even how healthy they were. But it can also preserve bits of things that you breathe in, like pollen, like soot particles. You can tell a surprising amount from what you find on people's teeth. And really anything that's in your mouth at that crucial moment can be preserved. And there was a case about 10 years ago of a woman who was found to have the pigment lapis lazuli in her plaque. She'd lived around 1100 AD in a monastic community in Germany at Dalheim. And it's thought that she was a manuscript artist who would have licked her brush and then dipped it into lapis lazuli and then put it back in her mouth again for the next lick and the next dip.
Oh, wow.
And so that's how it got into her mouth. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Because until then, I think that we had assumed from signatures and so on manuscripts that most manuscripts, or even maybe all manuscripts, were written by men. And this was clear archaeological proof that women were involved too. They may not have signed the manuscripts, but they were certainly painting them.
I'm just thinking about brushing my teeth now, mm-hmm. and that actually all the things I use to do it are pretty modern inventions, really. I mean, I use toothpaste with all sorts of chemicals and fluoride and things like that in it, which help to strengthen and preserve my teeth. I'm using an electric toothbrush, but I suppose I could use a normal manual toothbrush, but that's got all sorts of special plastic bristles. But surely in times gone by, people's teeth health will not have been anywhere near as good.
No, not if they had a diet that was like the modern diet, but no toothbrushes and floss and so on like we have today. I am old enough, actually. When I was quite little, I once had a natural bristle toothbrush and it didn't work nearly as well. It was, you know, a green fad I was going through and it didn't last long. But I think that you can get better and more biodegradable things now. But in those days, it was either nylon or it was bristle something like bristle. Anyway.
Yeah.
Toothbrushes don't seem to predate the Victorian period, as far as I know. But before that, people used little rags to clean their teeth. They wiped their teeth with these little rags. So you could do some kind of tooth cleaning before plastic toothbrushes. But of course, people simply didn't eat as much sugar before the Victorian period either. And really, medieval and earlier skeletons, the thing that you notice a lot of the time is not only are their teeth beautifully straight, and we don't quite know why that is, as far as I'm aware, but they're also quite often very, very beautifully preserved in terms of decay. They're often worn down, and sometimes you can see where people have had abscesses, where something's gone catastrophically wrong, but they don't have the usual kind of decay that we do. But thinking about Laura's question about what are we losing from the archaeological record, it's difficult, isn't it? Because the point of the archaeological record is its truthfulness. It's not like history, where you can write down something that simply isn't true, and if your historical document manages to survive, you'll end up giving a completely different wrong interpretation of life to the future. There's that old adage that the spade cannot lie, and that the rubbish and the physical remains that we leave to the future are kind of neutral and truthful. So I don't think that clean teeth is the worst thing that we're doing to the future archaeological record, because everything that humans do is part of that record. So what you'd be able to do is look at our rubbish and our bodies and know that we've got quite a sugary diet, quite an ultra-processed diet, a diet low in fibre. It's just bad for our teeth. And yet we have these beautiful, clean teeth. So that is going to show to the future that we have dentists. And that is something that marks our lives out as different to those of our remote ancestors. So it's going to be evidence for dentists, which is different to evidence for diet, but we're probably going to leave behind so much plastic packaging that will be the evidence for our diet. So I don't think it's... I don't like the idea of modifying what we do to help future archaeologists, because it's going to be a bias. And the only one that I'm planning to do is to have my coffin plate with details of all my major diseases, injuries, date, how old I was when I died, and so on. I think that's my little bit of help I'm going to give to future archaeologists. But anything other than that, it'll bias the record.
Laura, that is such a good question. I think possibly one of my favourites, because it's outside the box, but yet is so, so relevant to archaeology. So thank you so much for that one. Really enjoyed it. Let's see what Jackie's question is. This is Jackie Leeming, who says, is the age of large-scale excavation dead? That is the question, but there is more detail here. I visited Richborough Roman Fort last summer, and it was fascinating. After watching the GeoPhys special, this is the preliminary work that was done at Brancaster, of course, with John Gator and his team. It was mentioned that the excavation is invasive. If new sites like Richborough or Housesteads or Vindolanda are found and not extensively excavated in the future, do we lose a way of engaging the public? I love visiting old places, and it would be a shame if newly discovered old places are not excavated and left on show so that the public is able to visit.
Oh, well, there's a lot wrapped up in that question. Really interesting, Jackie, to hear that you visited Richborough, because that's one of the shore forts, the Roman shore forts, that it's thought that Brancaster matches. Brancaster's the one at the northern end, and Richborough, of course, in Kent, is towards the southern end of that chain of forts. You say, is the age of large-scale excavation dead? I actually think that that large-scale excavation is bigger than ever before, because we've got so many of these large infrastructure projects, things like high-speed rail and nuclear power stations and pipelines, cable projects and so on. And the interesting thing about those is that the archaeology within them is completely unpredictable. Nobody knows exactly what is there before they start the geophysics or the trial trenches. They're not put there for archaeological reasons, these infrastructure projects. They're put there for modern purposes, and so they're like a random sample. But because they're so big, they produce so much archaeology. So the HS2 line, you might remember, that allowed the excavation of an entire medieval church at Stoke Mandeville in Buckinghamshire. And that excavation found a Roman mausoleum underneath, which was completely unexpected. And that's so rare to do a complete excavation of a medieval church. Have a lot of them got Roman mausolea under them? We just don't know. Then if you look at the Elizabeth line, work there included the first ever DNA analysis of human bones that found plague bacteria. That was the start of that kind of research. And that was an amazing thing to happen. Then work in advance of Sizewell C, the nuclear power station there, that's given us a whole new Anglo-Saxon cemetery with some really interesting links to Sutton Hoo.
Yeah, they found a horse, didn't they, there? I swear,
that's
we were talking
right.
about it a few weeks ago.
Yeah, a horse grave and also cremations in ring ditches, which are... We don't know what they mean, but we can see the patterns of their distribution. They're found at Sutton Hoo, they're found at Sizewell, they're found in Germany. What does that mean? But because those are kind of rescue excavations, because they're in advance of development, they're part of the planning process, they're part of construction, they are really hard to display to the public. So the Sizewell Anglo-Saxon cemetery, that's going to have the infrastructure of a nuclear power station on top of it. You aren't really going to be able to visit and see anything. It's all got to go into museums. And the kinds of research projects that Jackie mentions, those have got above ground remains, and so it makes it much easier to turn them into places that can be visited, and also it makes it easier to turn them into the kind of research that the public can join in with. So in these huge dangerous high-stress building sites like HS2, it's impossible, or almost impossible, to get volunteers in, to have any public open days, things like that. Whereas something like a castle or a medieval fort, it's so much easier. But the trouble with those ones that have upstanding remains is we've known all about them all for a long time because they're very visible. So there aren't very many new ones to be discovered. So huge new and incredible sites that are discovered and could be used for research excavations, something like the huge villa at Broughton Castle that Time Team excavated.
Which we were talking about last week, yeah?
Yes, that's right. Now, the villa at Broughton, I mean, obviously Broughton Castle itself is an upstanding building that's there, and it's very easy to look at and to research. But the villa under the fields, that's very fragile. And once you've excavated it, it's really difficult to leave it on show for the public. It's always a big headache how to leave a legacy after an archaeological dig. I don't think it's one that we've entirely solved yet. You can try consolidating the walls, but all you end up with is one phase of what could be a multi-phase villa. Which bits do you choose to leave and not interrogate, not excavate, because you want to interpret them for the public? This is an ongoing problem, how you present archaeological research to the public. So Jackie, you've raised a really big and interesting problem, and it's one that I think we haven't yet solved.
And money, of course, is going to be a big part of this. I mean, the huge expense that preserving archaeology in its uncovered state must be. I mean, you know, Vindolanda must cost millions to keep going. And then, you know, don't even get you started on Pompeii, right? I mean, they've had to say, I think we need to stop doing new excavations at Pompeii. Part of the reason is because they can't necessarily afford to keep it all open and preserved.
Yes, because it is so difficult. Natural processes, particularly if something's outdoors, you can't stop decay entirely, and trying to, as you say, is immensely expensive.
Yeah, I'm thinking as well of the trip that I had to the Mary Rose. I know it's a slightly different thing. You know, we're talking about preserving organics, you know, the wood, but the amount of work that they had to do with all the air filters and all the special temperature controls, soaking it in special resins and things like that, all of that. And then you ask them, well, how long is it going to be able to stay like this? And they say, well, we don't know, but we hope for, you know, a few decades would be nice. And they don't know. Ultimately, it is you are going to lose it. It is going to decay. But I guess so is everything, even if you leave it in the ground.
Yes. It's one of these problems about a finite resource. What do we choose to do with it? And it changes from moment to moment. So the Mary Rose can be seen as an enormous experiment in maritime archaeology. What happens if you try to raise a ship? And it has resulted really in everybody else deciding that they're not going to raise a ship. The question can easily be asked, well, why don't you do it? It's been so successful with the Mary Rose. But normally people point to the Mary Rose and say, well, one project like that per country, per lifetime, is probably as much as we can manage. And the idea of trying to do it again, and of course, public expectations would be so much higher because of everything we've learnt from the Mary Rose. Yes, it's a terrifying prospect. I think if they'd known how difficult it was going to be, perhaps they would never have started. But we're so glad that they did.
We very, very much are. A brilliant question, Jackie. Thank you very much.
May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards. We'll be right back.
This is the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geig. And this week, I'm answering all of your wonderful questions.
Yeah, and there are a couple more to come. We'll get to those in just a moment. But if you are wondering, how can I be a part of this? How can I ask a question? How can I support Time Team? I know we bang on about it a lot, but there is a very good reason for that. It's because the reason that we're able to do the archaeology that we do, the reason that we can make podcasts like this, but also the programs, Time Team programs, that you're able to watch is because of your support. 5 years ago, Time Team came back thanks to your generosity, and we need your help to keep going and to keep doing what we do. So do join us as a Time Team member over on Patreon. Patreon.com/Time Team Official is where you need to go. And if you sign up there, one of the many, many things that you get to do is ask a question on this podcast. And we have bonus episodes that we bring to you, and we have behind the scenes, all sorts of stuff. Your usual Time Team episodes, by the way, you get ad-free. You often get them early. There's 3D models to look at. There's masterclasses. There's Dig Watch. I was in Mapperton just a few weeks ago, bringing you episodes of Dig Watch, taking you to the heart of a dig long before anybody else. So there's so much there over on Patreon. You also do get to ask a question in the chat section over on Patreon. So do that now. Patreon.com/Time Team Official. Let me bring you to the third question then, and it comes from Selena. This is Selena Allen, who says, I often wonder whether archaeologists of the future will be able to determine current archaeologists from their bones. Okay, this is good. Would someone like the legend Phil Harding have features in his knees and back, etc., that could show what his career was? Interesting.
Yes. Now, theoretically, absolutely, this is possible because you can have injuries and changes that are caused by repetitive activities. So these could be things like a bursitis or an arthritis, which ends up with different bone growth, new bone growth, that you can see, that you can measure on bones. So there's things like housemaid's knee, tennis elbow. There is something called weaver's bottom. Apparently, there's even a clergyman's knee. I don't know how clergyman's knee is different to housemaid's knee, but never mind. So maybe there might be something like archaeologist's knee or trowler's elbow. You also get things that are caused by the compression of your spine. If you're carrying heavy buckets or wheeling a heavy wheelbarrow, particularly young people, you can see the result in the spine. And you get bigger knobbles on your bones elsewhere. I think knobble is not a technical term, but that's how I think of them. Bigger kind of lumps.
Yeah.
Because where your muscles have attached, if the muscles are very big, they have a very strong attachment to the bone. And that's how ancient archers are identified. So there could also be something like shoveler's shoulder, maybe, if you're always using those particular muscles, and so you build up a particularly strong muscle attachment. But the thing is that rather like the difference between housemaid's knee and clergyman's knee, I'm not sure that there's any guarantee that an archaeologist would look any different from any other generally fit and strong person, because the movements and the strains within archaeological physical work, they're quite similar to things like maybe gardening or construction work and so on. So as usual, I'm afraid I'm going to come down with my defence of we don't have enough evidence yet, and what we really need is some archaeologists' skeletons to be put in a reference collection so that the Jackie McKinleys of 200 years' time can go and look at some archaeologists' skeletons and can compare them. That's what we really need. And that is why, again, I would put, when I die, I would like my coffin plate to say what I did for a living. But of course, I'm the kind of archaeologist that sits looking at small objects at a desk.
Yes, so you probably don't have archaeologist's knee or whatever it is.
No. I've got finds researcher's thumbnail.
Yes, something like that.
I'm not going to laugh.
No, I don't know. Yes, I do a lot of clicking, and I wonder whether that's got anything to do with my hand and wrist. I wonder if that would change that in some way. All right, I mean, I play the piano as well. I don't know whether that means my hands would be slightly more stretched than other people's. Unlikely, isn't it? I think.
Hard to tell from a grave as well.
Yeah, it's very difficult to tell from a grave. Yeah.
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 Yes, I don't know. That's a good question. I know that guitarists often end up with some interesting muscles in their forearms, but I don't know whether that leads to marks on bones.
Yeah, muscles is of no use really, is it, when you're looking at a skeleton. Anyway, you've got us thinking, haven't you? And that is a fantastic question, and that's the best way to do it. Get us thinking about the answer. Selena, thank you very much. Here comes the final question, and it comes from Laura. This is Laura Harris, who says, as a member of Time Team, what are you most proud of? Oh, what a good question. Laura goes on, is it a specific episode, the overall impact of promoting archaeology through an accessible show, or inspiring generations across a range of archaeological disciplines? Do you have anything you second guess or regret, a place you wish you'd left alone, etc.? Well, let's come to the regrets in a second. Let's talk about the things that you're most proud of. First of all, Helen, as a Time Team archaeologist.
Oh, well, I think everybody's going to have a different take on this, everybody in the team. But I think I'm most proud of the overall impact. And it's hard to know what would have happened if Tim Taylor and Mick Aston hadn't invented Time Team, if we'd never had it. But before Time Team, archaeology was a bit of a niche pursuit. And now it's grown to become something everybody's heard of and pretty much everybody's interested in. And the benefit of that is that it's now seen as being worth the money that it costs. And maybe if over the time since the mid-1990s when Time Team was first shown, maybe if all the archaeological knowledge since then had just disappeared into the scholarly journals like it used to, maybe people wouldn't think it was worth the money and maybe archaeology would have declined as a discipline. I don't know. We never know what might have been. But certainly I think Time Team has shown people how to value their past. It's shown people that it's worth doing this. And I think that that is quite a big thing. Not only that, I'm also really proud of how Tim and Mick, and of course Tony, how they made sure that we told those unheard stories, that they made sure that instead of like history being full of kings and queens and mayors and generals and admirals and so on, where those stories are pretty well known. But archaeology is and should be full of ordinary people. It's the farmers, it's the shopkeepers, it's the cooks, it's the soldiers and the sailors. Time Team always ensured that we tell those stories too. And I think it's what people want to hear about. I mean, we're always being told by Time Team members that what they really like are the community stories. Say what's happened to a single village across the centuries, the story of people who don't make it into the history books. And that's one of the things that I'm really proud of, that we've never just concentrated on the famous places, on the pyramids and the Roman villas and the cathedrals. We've done what archaeology really ought to do and stayed with ordinary people, ordinary lives, the 99% of the population.
I almost don't want, because I agree with everything you've said, and I wholeheartedly, and what an inspiration Time Team has been to the general public, but also to archaeologists. And it's gone some way, I think, as well, to helping redefine what people think of as an archaeologist. There would have been, you know, many, many decades ago, it was a preserve of very rich people who did it as a hobby. And now and so you have an idea in your mind of what that person might be like. And I think now people have a completely different idea of what an archaeologist looks like. Maybe some people would have thought it was Indiana Jones, but maybe now people have a more realistic view of who an archaeologist is, what an archaeologist is, and that has come about through Time Team, which is, I think, a wonderful thing. So I agree with all of that, and that is all wonderful, but Laura has asked the second part of the question here, which is the regrets and maybe something that you would second guess. So are there any regrets that you have?
It's difficult, really. The problem is that if you think of something that you think, well, maybe we bit off a bit more than we could chew there, you don't really regret that, because you only know that you've encountered a really complex and difficult site when you've encountered a really complex and difficult site. I don't think we've ever gone out to something that clearly was beyond 3 days and a relatively small team, because we just would we wouldn't do that. We would know that that was beyond us. So something like an entire church, we wouldn't even try. We'd do what Mick used to call condition, date, and extent. We'd find out how well preserved it was. We'd try to do a little bit of keyhole work to get a date, and we would do geophysics to make sure that we knew where it stopped, so to speak, spatially. So I think this is because I'm really not somebody who tends to regret things. I just think, oh, well, that happened, we learn, we move on. There are things that I'd like to do more of that I don't think we've done quite enough of yet. And those, I think, are giving people the tools to do things themselves. So Tim Taylor's produced books like Dig Village, which is brilliant if you want to look at your own village and do it yourself, to work on your own area. That's really great. And of course, you've been out with Stuart. You've told us a little bit about his secrets. But I think we could always do more. Of course, we could always do more. I'd like everybody downloading the first edition Ordnance Survey maps and colouring in the listed buildings in their village. I mean, that's a great thing to do. I'd like everybody to be able to spot a pollarded tree along a field boundary and thinking, oh, yes, I know what that's for. I want everybody to be looking at their church and the building, the phases of building, and maybe comparing those to half tax returns and wills and that kind of thing. And all that can be done without picking up a spade. You can do it by yourself, quietly, without involving anybody else, without asking any permission. You know, it's not to say that it's that easy. You need help often to start, but it's not difficult and it is really rewarding. So that's one of the things that I'd like to do more of.
You've got me thinking now about pollarded trees and why I would know anything about them. But anyway, I would have to leave that.
Well, yeah, and perhaps we ought to come back to that, because one of the most eye-opening books I've ever read was The History of the Countryside by Oliver Rackham. I had no idea that natural things could be archaeological too. So maybe we ought to do something more on that one episode of the podcast.
I think so. Yeah, you've got me scratching my head. But that is it for this episode. Don't forget, Time Team members get access to ad-free and bonus episodes of the podcast. You can get them as well by signing up on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for so much more from Time Team. Thank you so much if you've asked a question. And to the four people that we featured on this episode, a very special thank you. We will be back next week. We look forward to it. So from myself and from Helen, have a wonderful rest of your week, and we'll speak to you soon on the next Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye.
Is Maytag month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.